Hello and welcome to The Convert's Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Fospero. In 2010, when today's guest was 22, she made headlines as the youngest British woman to summit Mount Everest, the highest mountain on Earth. But what makes Benita Norris's great achievement even more remarkable is that she'd barely climbed so much as a hill, never mind a mountain, until she was at university. Yet she tackled the most unforgiving terrain and altitude, stepped over deep, treacherous crevasses on precarious, flimsy-looking metal ladders. I'm sure they weren't precarious, but they looked it. Conquering extreme physical and mental challenges to reach the dead zone, one of the most inhospitable areas on the planet, in the hope of seeing the curvature of the Earth from the highest vantage point. And today we're going to hear how and why she did it, perhaps against the odds. Benita, I watched you deliver an inspirational speech at a rail conference I hosted recently, and I can honestly say you could hear a pin drop as you recounted your story, particularly the footage that you had of the boots crossing those ladders I just talked about in the introduction. How on earth did a university student with no climbing experience end up on the summit of Mount Everest, aged just 22?
It's a good question. Helen, thank you so much for having me. I'm so delighted to be here. We only met a week ago and we're already recording a podcast together. I love your efficiency. How did it happen? Well, it all started because I went to a lecture about the mountains, and it was specifically about climbing Everest, given by two climbers, Kenton Call and Rob Casserly. And I just thought it was the most inspiring, beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And I left that lecture theatre thinking, that's what I want to do.
That isn't why you went to the lecture, is it, Benita? Let's be honest. You didn't go because you wanted to hear about mountaineering.
Yeah, there's nowhere to hide because you've heard my story, haven't you? Yes. So I think that one of the reasons that I went was this sort of joke between me and a friend. There'll be some hot guys there. But no, there were no hot guys there that evening. I did not find love that night, but I did fall in love with the mountains. Much better, long-lasting relationship.
Oh, I'm sure it was, and one that'll last a lifetime, obviously. What was it, though, at that meeting, all joking aside, that really captured your heart and imagination when they were describing what it's like?
The thing that I remember the most was them saying, when they got to the top of Everest, they looked down and they could see the curvature of the Earth. It was like they were looking down from a planet from space. And I didn't know that was possible even. I just thought it sounded like the most beautiful thing you could ever lay eyes on. So that was it for me. From that moment onwards, I left that room. It took a while, but I turned my life upside down and was just basically focused on this one vision of getting to the top of the world and seeing that sight with my own eyes.
Presumably there's so much to sort out, not least your fitness and training, funding, all that kind of thing. Where did you start with it all, and how did it all come about so it became a reality for you?
There was the training that I had to go through. Obviously, you can't just turn up and climb Everest. You have to have all the skills that you need as a mountaineer, but you also need to have a certain amount of fitness as well. I didn't have either. You also need a team to be accepted onto a climbing team. And then finally, perhaps the hardest thing was to find the money to climb Everest. It cost me in total, all in, about £50,000. And so I didn't have any money, any team, any climbing skills, any fitness. It was really starting from scratch. It took nearly 2 years to put all of those pieces together, but I think I just started very small by joining an indoor climbing wall, their beginner's course, literally turning up and I couldn't do a single pull up. I still can't do a press up to this day, pretty much. And being around all of these quite strong men, and I was saying, I'm going to climb Everest. And people were really like, you? Really? You can barely pull yourself off the ground. But as with everything in life, it was just a case of taking it one climb at a time, 1 week at a time. And eventually the crack moment came when I had to find the sponsorship, the money to climb the mountain, the 50 grand. And that felt to me like, okay, I can do the training. I can find a team. Like, that all makes sense. But where on earth am I going to get this money from? And managed to do it in the end. And getting to the bottom of Everest was in some ways the biggest achievement, just putting all those little pieces together.
And how did you manage the funding in the end? Because that's not easy. Presumably you've just finishing at uni or just have finished. So how do you put that kind of amount together at such a young age as well? Because I would imagine that's quite difficult.
The only option open to me to find £50,000, and I only had about 6 months to do it because we just finished with the climbing team that I really wanted to go to Everest with. They had an expedition plan to Everest in the spring of 2010. It was about 6 months from the point that I knew that I really could join. So the pressure was on. The days were ticking away, then weeks, then months, and I had to find £50,000 from somewhere. And the only way for me was no, I couldn't earn that money in that time. There was no one I could ask to help me out with that money. You've got to find a business to sponsor you. And so I set about making cold calls to British businesses and made, I feel like, hundreds of calls, got turned down by everyone. And in the end, in desperation, called a radio station, Till FM, and got on air talking about my plight. And that was what then got me the sponsorship, because listening to that radio segment was a marketing director from a company that I'd been in contact with. They said they didn't have all the money I needed. They were very interested. And when they finally heard me on the radio, they were like, okay, we get it now. Like, we can see this being a big deal. If you get to the top of Everest, you're going to be the youngest British woman to have done it. And we want to be part of that journey. So we've changed our minds and we'll give you every penny you needed. It scares me to this day, because if I hadn't called the radio station that morning, I don't think I'd be sitting here talking to you now. It was really like victory clutched from the jaws of failure. It was right at the last minute. My team had told me, if you really need the money, if you're so overdue, like if you can't get it to us soon, we can't have you on the trip. So I just, even to this day, I cannot believe that somehow managed to pull it out of the bag. But I think what I had back then was just this belief in showing up, putting yourself out there, just keep on trying. Eventually you'll get some good luck. And I did.
And how were the team themselves? I mean, how supportive were they of the fact that in terms of mountaineering, you were quite a novice? How supportive were they of your desire to achieve it and get to the summit?
Very, really, from the very beginning. I had been to the Himalayas with my team by this point before we went to Everest, and I had climbed an 8,000 meter peak with them, the eighth highest peak in the world. So by the time I got to Everest, I'd been to the death zone. I had had to use the oxygen systems before. There were a lot of people that showed up to Everest that had not done any of that. So in some ways, when I actually got to Everest, even though I felt like I was still a novice, I was around people that really were. And it made me realize, okay, that I'd actually done a lot more than others. And so when we got to the mountain, I think I felt like quite a very confident member of the team, very humbled by the fact that I was nowhere near as experienced as other people there. But I definitely felt like I belonged, which was a nice feeling, because on my first expedition, I just felt completely out of my depth every day, thinking this is the hardest day of my life. My team all hate me. I'm rubbish. Like, but they didn't give up on me, and I got to Everest in the end.
It's very difficult if you haven't been anywhere like Everest to imagine when you come out of your tent in the morning, what it looks like. I'm imagining snow and ice palaces. It must just feel like you're in a completely different world. I just wondered if you can take us there and describe that sense of what the scenery is like and what it feels like to be in a place like that.
Well, before you even open your eyes in the morning, you can hear the glacier cracking underneath you. And sometimes it's like gunshots going off. It's really loud cracks. And so you get a sense instantly that you are just a very small thing on this huge glacier. And at base camp, you can hear the Nepalese being spoken between the Sherpas. And you can hear the cowbells of yaks moving in and out of camp as well, delivering supplies. And it's a lovely sort of bucolic soundscape. And then when you open your tent, you're right. It is these ice palaces, these mountains just shoot up out of the glacier around you. And you're in like a horseshoe. To our right, we've got Everest and the Khumbu Icefall. And then to the left is a mountain called Pumori, which looks like this perfect shark tooth, if you like. And you're just in this amphitheater of the world's highest peaks. And often the weather was in the spring. So every day, like these bluebird skies, the sun instantly starts bearing down and you get really hot quite quickly, which is nice because the air is freezing cold. And at night, the stars are like nothing you've ever seen, just the most beautiful stars. And the sunrises too, and the sunsets. Oh my God, where to stop really? It's just the most beautiful, majestic place.
And how do you acclimatize to the thin air and the high altitude, and then obviously further on deal with the death zone when presumably you then need oxygen?
Yes. So we don't start using our oxygen systems at base camp. We only put them on really about 7,000 meters. So quite high up the mountain around camp three. And we have four camps on the mountain. Mainly these camps are established by our incredible Sherpa team. They carry the heavy loads. They carry oxygen and things like that. A godsend, really. I wouldn't be able to get to the top of these peaks without them. So we have these four camps. And the idea is that we go up to one camp at a time and we acclimatized to that one camp, because just going from base camp to camp one, which is only a few hundred meters difference in height, it's a huge strain on your body. Your body is suddenly dealing with a lot less oxygen. You're lying in your tent out of breath at camp one, and you have to then retreat back to base camp to recover. And the next time you go to camp one after that recovery, you actually feel okay. Like your body has adapted very quickly. That means you can then climb onto camp two. And we keep going up and down the mountain, exposing ourselves to ever higher altitudes, but then coming back and resting. And that just builds our resilience to the altitude and allows our body to basically grow red blood cells. And it's those new red blood cells that capture whatever dwindling amounts of oxygen are in the atmosphere. Body needs time and it needs rest. And if you give it those things, you will acclimatize. I just find that interplay, that relationship between the body and nature, just so interesting and fascinating. And then suddenly you find yourself up at camp four at 8,000 meters. And that is unimaginable. Like that's 8 kilometers above where we are now at sea level. And you've gone there because your body is this incredible thing that adapts to whatever you put it through. And I've never been more in love with my body than when I'm climbing a mountain, knowing just how hard it's working for me and how quickly it just gets on and adapts. And so we do those acclimatization rotations until we are ready to go up to the summit. And then once you're in the dead zone, you're on oxygen. There is no acclimatization in the dead zone. You cannot adapt to the dead zone. You're just on borrowed time. And then, yeah, you just get to the top as fast as you can from there.
Hold that thought about being on borrowed time in the last bit for a moment. But when you go back, when you retrace your steps and you go back to each camp, what does it feel like when you're breathing and acclimatizing and resting?
When you are at a new altitude for the first time on that expedition, you're up at 7,000 meters for the first time, it does feel like even when you're lying in the tent, you are sprinting on a treadmill and trying to breathe through a straw. You just cannot get enough air into your body. And for me, it's always the worst night, that first night at a new altitude. But then your body's working so hard for you in the background. The next morning, you feel tired, but it's okay. And the next time you come back to it, you're like, oh, what was I making a fuss about?
The body is incredible. And as well as the physical side of Everest, of course, there's the mental challenge. And when you're climbing, how much time do you spend thinking about risk? We all know many climbers have lost their lives on Everest. And I suppose when you're climbing, there's risk of avalanche from nowhere. So when you're actually there, Benita, are you really focused on the task in hand, and have those thoughts about risks taken place before you've even landed in the Himalayas?
Yeah, I feel like the hardest part of the expedition is before you get there mentally. When you arrive on the mountain, it's such a relief, because for weeks beforehand, I've been questioning myself, is it the right decision? What if I never come back? I'm leaving my family. And then you actually arrive and you're like, thank goodness, now we can just get on with it. I can deal with whatever comes at me. I always say to myself, I'm only ever climbing until it's not right to go on. So for me, on certain expeditions, the only thing that's gotten me on the plane to go to the Himalayas or the Karakoram is just saying to myself, all I have to do is fly to Islamabad and Kathmandu. And if I don't like it, I'll just get back on the plane and I'll go home. And then it's like, okay, but if you get there, then I can take the Jeep and drive out to Skardu, whatever it is on the cusp of the Karakoram. And I just keep doing that. And that's mentally how I get my head around it. But on the mountain as well, I've just always had a mantra, which is just to focus and not fret. It is really hard. As you said, the risk is there. I've had friends that have died in the mountains, not because they've made any mistake, but just because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it's incredibly difficult not to be constantly worrying about what might happen next. Avalanches just are a fact of life when you're up there. Falling rock, anything at any moment can happen. And we really are aware that to expect the unexpected. But if you aren't concentrating on literally what you're doing in that moment, then you will make a mistake. So there's just no point fretting about something you can't change. I cannot stop an avalanche if it's coming towards me, but I can concentrate on moving well, moving efficiently, making sure I don't drop anything, looking after myself, keeping an eye out on conditions. Those are the things that are within my control. And it's just a huge part of the mental side of mountaineering and dealing with the risk is just being able to ask yourself, right now, is it safe to take another step? And if it is, just take it. Don't overthink it. But at the same time, understand that, of course, anything can go wrong. You need to be ready. but I cannot control an avalanche and I need to just be okay with that. You just have to live with that discomfort all the time. And the moment that you don't feel comfortable anymore, I'm quite happy with turning around, really. If I get a sixth sense or a funny feeling that something's not right, the mountain will always be there. And so I'm always quite happy to pull back, maybe earlier than other people, just because I feel like there's no need to take a huge risk. We're never in control on these things. Better to pull away and regret pulling off the peak.
I think the razor sharp focus, a great example of that is the ladders that I mentioned in the introduction. And the reason I mentioned them is when I watched you speak to a big audience, you had a bit of film footage which you talked over, and it was basically boots. I don't know if it was your boots.
No, our Sherpas.
Your Sherpa's boots with the sort of, I'm going to get this all wrong, but it looked like crampons. Is crampons right? It's got the sharp bits on. And it's those steps over the deep drops. And what I was quite surprised to learn is there's not one of those. I think you said there are around 20 of those you had to cross. Can you describe what that aspect of the climb is like? And what was it like for you the first time, perhaps not on Everest, but the first time you did one of those?
The first time I came across a ladder on a mountain was on Everest.
Was it?
I feel like it's quite unique to Everest because there were no ladders on K2. There's no ladders on any other mountain. I just feel like on Everest, there is that there's a more organized commercial side to it, which is like, how can we get people up and down as quickly as... If I'm honest, the first ladder crossing, we're climbing through the icefall. It takes us about 5 hours to get through the icefall. It's this frozen waterfall, really, a glacier that's cascading down this valley. All this ice is churning over, huge blocks above your head, some of the size of houses. And then there's these huge drops because the ice is also cracking open as it moves. So you're making your way through this icefall. And some of the crevasses, well, most of them are just small enough to step across, but others are big enough that you could fit a bus into. But in that instance, we have these ladders just to get people through quickly before ice falls on you. About 20 or so, I never counted, but it felt at least like that many of these crossings. And the first one, I was frozen to the spot. I just had every voice in my mind telling me why I was going to die. And I think in the end, you just have to not think. I think as human beings, we have this wonderful piece of machinery in our skull and it works so well for us, our brains. But equally, my imagination has this amazing ability to freak me out and tell me that I can't do something. And I think the only thing that sometimes gets me moving when I'm really scared is just trying to block everything out and just focusing on one thing. And it was just putting my foot on that ladder, the first rung of the ladder, not trying to guess what might happen after that, but just getting moving. And the physical act of starting to walk, then you'll find your leg is following and then you're on the ladder. And boy, you just got to keep going. Just that focus, not fret mantra just coming back. And then after that, I'm not proud to say it, but you get really blasé, totally blasé. You're just like picking up a bit of rope, just walking across, running across, not even wearing your crampons, just walking across in your slippery boots. And I've seen the aftermath of someone who probably rushed and fell. And it was one of the worst things I have ever seen. And that was a real shocker and made me realize that actually you need to treat these ladders with respect. Of course, we're constantly moving as fast as we can because of what might fall on us. And so you do rush. And yeah, I'm lucky to be here, I think.
Is there a lovely sense of camaraderie and team spirit when you go back to the tent, when you've gone up to a camp and then you've come back down again? Do you discuss the climb, discuss how the day was? And is there a lovely sense of satisfaction that you've got to the next step, if you like, on your journey?
When you're up on the mountain, you're often sharing a tent with one other teammate. And when we started the expedition, there was another woman on the team, but she quit about a camp two, second time we went onto the mountain. So she wasn't around for very long. I really enjoyed sharing a tent with her. Ultimately, I don't really remember going over all the details of the day. The stuff I remember is like fantasizing about all the food we were going to eat. We got back home and like being like, what's your favorite restaurant and like what would you order and what do you eat on Christmas Day and what's your favorite breakfast? It's really banal stuff like that. Yeah, those are the conversations that I remember more than anything else. Just hours really of chatting about home life. Someone once said to me, this climber, he said that when I'm at home, I want to be on the mountain, and when I'm on the mountain, I want to be at home. It sounds like we were just desperate to leave.
So when you get high enough to the point where you're going to summit, talk me through that. When you get to the dead zone, what happens and why do you climb at night and all that kind of thing?
So the dead zone is this loose term to describe anything above 8,000 meters or anything above the height where a human body can adapt to the altitude. To adapt to 7,000 meters is pretty impossible. The proper death zone we describe is above 8,000 meters. There's only about 30% of the oxygen up there than we have at sea level. So you're in your tent at Camp 4 on the South Col. It's this desolate place, windy, not very pretty. And you pile into the tent, you get there at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, having had a big day climbing up from Camp 3. And then it's just these few hours really until 11 p.m. when we leave the tent again and climb through the night and hopefully reach the top of the world just after sunrise. The reason we're going to do that is because there's no point sleeping up there. We're just going to waste our oxygen. So we may as well just leave the tent, get to the top as fast as we can and get out of there. So those few hours counting down to 11 p.m., there's just a lot of admin, tent min as we call it, to get done, boiling ice to make water to take with us, strapping up our feet, all of our blistered feet, making sure that we've got no flesh on show, making sure the oxygen systems work, just trying to grab some rest. It's a lot of stuff to tick off, making sure you've got all your kit and it's exactly where it needs to be and spares and everything else. And then countdown is on and you're sitting there waiting and it's just that awful, what am I doing here? Like, why don't I just stay in this nice, warm, safe, orange bubble? It's so cozy. Go home to England and tell everyone I got to Camp 4 and everyone would be like, wow, that's amazing. Like, you've gone so well. And I'm like, yeah, maybe I'll just get to Camp 4. Like, I don't have to go out in the death zone at night when it's like minus however many degrees. I'll just stay here. I've done a good job to get this far. I'll just stay here. That is what our minds do, right? If we want an excuse, our brain will just be there with one. And that night it was like, you've done a good job. You don't need to go any further. The reason I was thinking that was because the other side of me was going, well, better mountaineers than me have died on this final bit. So who the hell do I think I am? Ultimately, I just realized I had to stop overthinking of an excuse, of a reason not to go, of why I wasn't good enough, and just focus on one thing. And that one thing just became, I'm going to take one step out of the tent. If I don't like it, I'll come back inside. I'll stay here all night, but I just have to take one step out. Of course, when I did that step, there was no way I was going back inside the tent. The hardest step had been done, if you like. So yeah, that was the preparation. And then we climbing literally in the darkness. I remember just not being able to see hardly anything except from the beam of light of our head torch. And that next step, basically, everyone's quiet because you're all in your own battle as to why you're carrying on and battling to lift your feet off the ground because you're so tired for breath. And you all just go into your own worlds, really. And we just climb in this line up toward the stars.
What do the stars look like at that point? Are they breathtaking?
They are, but we really, for the most part, just not even, I forgot the world beyond the beam of my head torch existed. All that I had was like the next footstep and the pain of the next footstep as well. Just lifting your leg off the ground, it just costs so much. It's so slow. Everyone's moving so slowly, like taking a step, catching your breath, taking another step. It wasn't until one of my teammates told me to turn off my head torch for a second. And I did this. It was my Sherpa Lakpa. And I saw the stars finally. And they did look amazing. I remember just feeling like I was sitting on a planet, like sitting on one of Saturn's rings and just looking out at the galaxy. It wasn't like the stars were above us anymore. We were just in them. They were beneath us. It was just so beautiful.
Does your mind play any tricks with you at that point? And do you have to be careful that your mind doesn't play tricks because of the lack of oxygen up there?
Definitely. Yes. I mean, I hallucinated. I thought that there was an ice cream van, parasols outside. And every time I looked at it, it disappeared. But then I'd look away and it would be there. Many people, many climbers describe having the third man, this shadowy figure that they think is with them, a presence, and then nobody there. But this is quite a common thing, especially at extreme altitude and or when you're so exhausted just from not having slept and from the toil of getting to this point. So it's very normal. But yes, when people get hypoxic, they get oxygen starved, it's the brain that suffers and you make all sorts of decisions. People take off their clothes.
Wow.
You know, and
I'll stick with the ice cream van.
There's some of this really weird phenomenon that people do when they are really hypoxic and really sick from altitude. But for most people, it's just a case of maybe a few visions, just a sort of loss of time. But you don't need to always be firing on all cylinders, I find. Like sometimes just being able to focus on, like, just keep going. And your body gains and loses energy. You just have to keep pushing through them.
And do you climb with medics? Have you got a doctor in the team or anything like that?
Not officially. On my direct team on Everest, we didn't have a doctor, but there was a team that we were joined with, and there's a doctor, Rob Cassidy, was on that team. So it was nice to know that he was nearby, but certainly it's not the case that you would traditionally climb with a doctor. He just happened to be one.
So you made it. You got to the summit. What was it like when you got to the summit?
It was a relief. It was just a relief. When I imagined getting to the top at home in my bedroom for years before I actually got there, I really imagined like the crescendo of music, the helicopter filming me from above as I ran to the top and I punched the air. And then actually when I got there, it was just this little shuffle onto the summit. I fell to my knees and just remember pressing my hands into the snow and saying to myself, this is it. But you can't take it in. There's nothing that can prepare you to understand like the gravity of this moment, that you are one of the very few people that's been lucky enough to stand at the highest point in the world. You just can't take that in, especially when your brain is starved of oxygen. So for me, it was just the relief, really, because so many people had told me, someone like us, we can't do stuff like this. And I believed that as well, to a point, just that great things like that happen to other people. So to be able to not listen to those voices and actually just push on with and follow that dream, which didn't always make sense. And it was an amazing feeling to know that I was right to trust that kind of gut instinct, really. And the relief of knowing that after all that risk, that worry, that hoping, but not knowing, and will it all go wrong, like to get there, it was just, yeah, it was just an amazing feeling of relief.
And what did the curvature of the earth look like, which had inspired you in the first place?
I must say it was a bit underwhelming. It was really cloudy and it was a whiteout almost. It almost felt like it was getting dark. There was a lot of cloud that day. So I really just couldn't take in the view at all. Like I couldn't make out what was through all this cloud. And I just, I had this thought in my oxygen starved mind that was just like, this is just like Wales, which is where I'd done all of my training. So yeah, that was what I felt like when I got to the top. It's just like, oh, this is like Snowdon.
And didn't your Sherpa take off his oxygen mask and have a fag at the top?
Not mine, but yeah.
Not yours.
They get onto the top and they have a celebratory ciggy. And good for them. There's no way I would be able to take off my oxygen mask to light a cigarette on the top of Everest. But the Sherpas are just a different level. Some of them have climbed it 10, some 20 times. And I think to them, it's just like, it's a nice moment, but it's like they've done it 10 times already. Like, no big deal to them. Whereas for me, I'm on top of the world.
It is a remarkable achievement, Benita. I mean, when you describe what it's like, you can see what a great achievement it is to get there. But of course, it's not game over getting to the summit, because you also have to get down safely. And for you, the getting down wasn't as perhaps easy as the getting up, was it?
Going down a mountain is easier physically. Like finally, gravity's on your side. You're not working against it. But with that, you can make many more mistakes because you're just moving a lot quicker. You're excited to get back to base camp. Concentration is lost because you're thinking about what you're going to eat when you get home or whatever it is. And I picked up a piece of rope that was caught around a rock. And I then went to lower off the edge of the Hillary step on it. So what we often do in the mountains is, on these big mountains, is there's ropes in situ, and we call them lines, and you arm wrap. So you take one arm, you wrap it around the rope a few times and it creates drag. And then with that drag, you can just lean over quite vertical, not just off vertical sort of cliffs and slopes and stuff, and just run down with using the drag to hold you steady. And so I did this arm wrap and I leaned forward. And as I then stepped over the edge, this rope pinged off the rock that it was caught around and all this slack came into the rope. So I fell, I tumbled, landed thankfully on the Hillary step, which is this high ridge just below the summit of Everest. And in the movie Everest, the disaster where Rob Hall died on the Hillary step, this is where we're talking, like really high up on the mountain. And I landed on it, thankfully, not a kilometer below. And I was okay, I thought. It wasn't really a big deal at the time. We tried to carry on, but just instantly, I was just like, I can't move. Every time I take a step, I'm getting lightning bolts going up my spine, into my neck, into my brain, down my shoulder. And it was just the worst pain I'd ever felt. And I had no idea what I'd done. So that was quite scary. But I just couldn't move. It was just agony just to even lift my foot off the ground. This went on for a while. We sat, we rested. And everybody started to pass us on the way down the mountain. And soon I realized that there was no one else behind this last person that was passing us. And he was the only person to stop out of maybe 60 people. He's like, "You're okay? I hurt my neck." He just poured some pills into my hand and he said, "Good luck." And then he went. And then it was just me and Lakpa. And it was a very cloudy day. And I just remember this cloud kind of gathering beneath us and it was all going dark. And me and Lakpa were up in the death zone alone. Suddenly we're in our own disaster movie, basically.
And how do you recover from that? What did Lakpa do and how did you get over the pain you were in and be able to continue?
We were sort of on the radio to base camp and our leader, who was back at camp 4, they were saying like, "You're going to be okay. You just got to get moving." And nothing was getting through. And then Lakpa just looked at me and he was like, "If we don't move, we're going to die." And that was, for me, it was like, okay, the fear in his eyes, I'll never forget. It was exactly what I needed to hear. He was angry and he was just not taking any shit anymore. Sorry. And he was just like, "We're going to die. So we're going to go." And it was what I needed to hear. Sometimes you just need to tell people it straight without sugarcoating it. And he did that. And for me, from that point, I don't know where the energy came from, but I was like, "I am getting out of here. We are not dying here. I'm not letting Lakpa die here," was basically what I was thinking. And so I managed to climb up. When disasters do happen up high on Everest, people get called the Hillary Step, like Rob Hall, because you have to climb up the South Summit, which is this other sort of mini peak. I think it just mentally and physically just overwhelms people when they're really near death's door already. And I just didn't want to be one of those people. So we found a way to get to the summit. It was just blinding pain, the South Summit. But I got to the top of it. And then on the other side was one of my teammates, Rick, waiting for me and helped me down as well. And then when we got back down to the south balcony, we could then see down toward our tents and some more people came up and helped me. And it was just a huge effort from so many people who did not need to help at all that came out and just did whatever they thought would be useful. And I got back to camp 4 and we were all okay. Rick, unfortunately, got a little bit of frostbite on his fingers and refused to make a big deal out of it at all. But seeing that for me, like, I was devastated because he was more injured than I was at this point. And I just felt so guilty. And it was that getting off the mountain a few days later and going back home, it was actually that guilt that stayed with me so much more than the success and stayed with me.
Did it?
Yeah.
I think your mum and dad, your poor mum and dad, had a call to say you'd perished at one point. Maybe that was when you fell and that must have been so frightening and awful for them.
Yeah, so the communications back, especially back then, we only had satellite phones and radios to contact home or contact base camp when we're up on the mountains. Today, I think you can use 4G on the summit of Everest, but it wasn't like that back then. And so they found out that I'd got to the top, then so they were really happy, but then they knew that it was the way down that was dangerous. So they were waiting, but hoping it was all fine. And then they got a call in the night saying like, "Have you heard anything from her? We think she might have fallen. Like, do you know if she's alive or dead?" I think my stepdad rightly put the phone down.
Oh my goodness. So that stayed with you. Did you feel in some ways that you held on to success and failure when you came back? Because I would imagine everybody was thrilled for you that you'd summited, but was that fall still very much in your heart and something you had to overcome so you could carry on climbing mountains?
I think I've always been very hard on myself generally. Even if things go really well, I'm always thinking about what I could have done better. So this was just the worst thing because I'd obviously achieved this dream of mine and it was time to celebrate, but and getting home alive and all the things I'd missed, I was so happy to come home to. But it was all just tinged with this like deep upset, really, that it was one mistake. I should have just taken an extra moment. I shouldn't have let Rick get frostbite on his fingers. And I just felt really annoyed with myself and really bad. And I think like we all beat ourselves up. But for me, it was a real catalyst. I remember so many people saying, "Well, look, you're back. You don't ever have to go to a mountain again. You've climbed the highest one. You can just hang up your climbing boots. You've done it." And I was like, maybe, but also there's no way I can leave it like this. There's no way I can finish on that note. The mountains are now unfinished business for me. I need to go and put this right. And I just had this real feeling that I wanted to prove to my teammates that I was not that climber that just make a silly mistake and then never return. I wanted to continue having that relationship with them, we're going climbing with them. So that became the goal after that, was just being so driven to never make that mistake again and go and climb something that proves that
And did you go and do that?
Yeah, so it took a while. I mean, I really did have a bit of a crisis of confidence. I started from scratch again, pretty much. I got back in the summer and I was just climbing on sea cliffs and climbing little things, just reconnecting with nature and the movement and not thinking about all the big things of like breaking records or getting the press attention or sponsorship. It was just like, why do I love climbing? Once I just got back into that love for it, it was then, okay, there's the next mountain. And it got bigger and bigger until about 2 years later, I was climbing up to the top of the world's fourth highest peak with Lakpa, who was the one that said, like, if we don't move, we're going to die. So he had put a lot of faith in me to continue climbing with me. This was like the second expedition we'd done since Everest and our fifth, I think, in total. And so for him, I'm grateful for his faith. After everything that happened, we reached the summit of Lhotse, which is the world's fourth highest peak. It was way more tough than Everest in every single way. Really hard technical mountain, hardly anyone there, basically. But the beauty of Lhotse is that it's actually joined to Everest, so that when you get to the summit of Lhotse, you can look out and you can see the climbers going up to the top of Everest. And they're so close, you can reach out and touch them. And we were sitting on top of Lhotse. I was in complete euphoria. I've never had a summit moment like it where I really did feel like I was on top of the world. I was just so grateful to have not quit on myself, to have picked myself up and carried on climbing after that low point. So thankful that I was there with Lakpa and being able to squeeze his hand and look out across to Everest together and say, thank you for saving my life. And he's a bloke, a chap. And he was just like, cool. That was all I got from him. It was a very heartfelt moment. When people say, oh, do you regret that you fell? Would you turn back the clock and not have it happen? No, I understand now, looking back, I can connect the dots and I can see that it was supposed to be part of the journey. Everest was never supposed to be the ending, only the beginning, really. And I'm grateful for that fall. I think that failure taught me so much more than if it had just been an easy success. And it drove me to become a better climber. And it drove us to have this amazing experience together, which we maybe never have had. So actually, I think your failures drive your biggest successes in some ways.
I'm sure they can. And that's probably just one of many lessons that you've learned from the various climbs you've done that you can relate to everyday life and also business as well, because they're life lessons, aren't they, that you learn up there?
Absolutely. Everything is stripped back. You are just surviving. You're dealing with people. It's stressful. There's a lot of uncertainty and you're having to use your mind and your body to solve this really complex problem of how to get to the summit and work with other people to do so. And it's like an MBA in turbocharged into like 1 month. You are learning so much about how to deal with people, how to deal with yourself. And I'm forever grateful for the lessons the mountain has taught me. They're really hard, hard learned lessons, some of them. But they've given me, in my times of need in life, I'm so lucky that I can reflect on the mountains. And there's always an answer. Whatever the problem is for me, there's something that I've been through in the mountains that helps guide me in whatever present problem I'm in.
And what is it, Benita, about the mountains and these tough climbs that keep you going and keep you wanting more? What is the draw for you and the appeal, and what gives you the drive to put yourself through all this? Because it's definitely not easy stuff.
I can't think of a better way to spend a day than just to be on a mountain. It doesn't have to be a big one. Even, as I said, I only started climbing when I was 20, but looking back, you can connect the dots of my childhood going on my year six school trip to Wales, to the mountains there. And I remember feeling like I was the only one that enjoyed it. Like my friends complained the whole week about the blisters and having to wear a heavy backpack. And I just remember waking up every day thinking, this is the best fun I've ever had. Going on the school ski trip at the age of 14 and being on the chairlift with my friends and crying because I was so in awe of the mountains and my friends being like, are you okay? And then again, like when I was 18, going on a trip to Machu Picchu in Peru and climbing the mountain at Machu Picchu. And again, writing on my blog home, which I think only my mother read, like that's the best day of my life. I can't imagine. It was always in me that the mountains were just my happy place. And as a child, I never put two and two together. Climbing just wasn't a thing where I grew up and when I grew up. Now there are climbing walls everywhere. There's so much more opportunity with Duke of Edinburgh and things like that for young people to get out and discover that passion. But times that I did, it just never clicked that this was something I could ever turn into a hobby. I'm so grateful that I finally found it when I was 20. But I just can't imagine life without the mountains, really. Tenzing Norgay said, Everest for me was greater than any pull or force on earth. And I totally understand that. You just cannot put your finger on it. If you don't get it, you never will. But just being in the mountains is where I feel at peace. I feel like the mountain talks to me. I feel at home there very much. And even though they're scary and they're hard, it always makes sense. I know it doesn't make sense to say that, but you always feel like the mountain's teaching you something or showing you something about yourself or about others. And they're the greatest teachers. And talking about them just makes me want to go back.
I'm in awe of the mountains too. And I think you're so at one with nature and you have to have so much respect, but particularly when you're in mountains, yeah. You know, like the sorts of mountains in the Himalayas and places like that. You're a mum now, you've got a young daughter and a baby boy. And I just wondered how that's changed your ambitions and whether you're still driven to go and climb the big peaks or whether it's changed your perspective on risk being a mum.
Yes, it definitely has. I think it's the most natural thing in the world and I accept it fully. There is so much more to life. I mean, after that big spiel I've just done, there is so much more to life than the mountains. And my love for my children is just indescribable. I can't imagine ever not wanting to be with them. And unfortunately and tragically, I do know of families growing up without a parent because of the mountains. And that parent didn't do anything wrong. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so for me, it's okay to become more risk averse. I want to be there for my kids. That's my priority. I think that as parents, we should still go out there and take risks because something that we need to do, we need nature to teach us things and to not always just be comfortable and safe. It's an important part of just being human is to put yourself into Mother Nature and test yourself, I think. So I will continue to climb. My husband, thankfully, is a rock climber. So we do have a routine of climbing indoors a lot. And we occasionally get to go on a climbing holiday outside once in a blue moon now with kids. But in the long term, certainly, I want my daughter and my son to see me going off to the mountains. I don't want to do anything super dangerous. But the mountains have never been about chasing those thrills for me. It's never been about what's the biggest risk I can take. It's always just been about wanting to see the curvature of the earth or wanting to see these beautiful places. And I will be happy on any mountain as long as I have a good view.
And hopefully, as your children get bigger, they'll enjoy some of the mountains with you. I'm sure they'll probably end up sharing your passion. I think when you grow up with parents who are passionate about something, often that's a passion that's shared from children. So I'm sure you'll take them on some great trips. But what mountain is next? When the children are big enough, I know you've recently had your baby, but when the children are a little bit older, what's in your sights in terms of a new challenge? Or and also, what is the challenge when you've done Everest and you've done some of those really high peaks? What else really excites you and what places do you want to go and see?
I have loads of challenges and projects that don't include the mountains at all. I'm trying to write a TV series at the moment, unsuccessfully with a baby and a job, but it's ongoing. So that would be a huge achievement that doesn't have anything to do with climbing. In terms of the mountains, though, there is one particular like challenge I'd love to take on, which would be to climb an 8,000 meter peak, Chowri Yu in Tibet, Swat's sixth highest peak, and to do that maybe without using the supplemental oxygen. I think that would just be a great challenge for me within my acceptance of risk. And I would love to do that. There's no time limit on it. I've climbed with people in their 60s. The oldest woman to climb Everest was 73. So it's one of a wonderful hobby that you can have right into the end of your life, really. And so I'm glad I've chosen it for that reason, but really annoyed that it's so risky, unfortunately. But yeah.
I think Sir Chris Bonington climbed the Old Man of Hoy at 80. He accepted a challenge from the One Show who challenged him to it, and he did it, which was absolutely amazing. It does lead us nicely onto risk. As I messaged you earlier, we have ended every podcast in this season by asking people, what's the biggest risk you've ever taken in life? Which kind of feels slightly daft for me to be asking you that, but it doesn't have to be Everest. But I just wondered, Benita, in your lovely young life, what would you say that biggest risk is?
Yeah, well, I do. You've definitely shared it with you, like taking £50,000 from a business and saying, I'm going to go and climb Everest with it. That was a huge risk, not wanting to let anyone down and not let myself down. You did ask me the question earlier so I could prepare, and I did reflect on it. And I think one was back in 2015, I set up a climbing holidays business. And it was the most stressful experience of my life, trying to get people to pay to come on this holiday, sign people up, and you've got climbing coaches that are booking time off and blah, 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 and pulling all this whole thing together and getting 30 people to Greece on a climbing trip. The most stress I've ever been under, and just up to the hilt in debt and trying to pay people and owing people money. And I was like, why am I doing this all the time? I just want to go climbing. Just why have I done this? But anyway, we got to Greece, and on that trip, I met my husband. Oh. So if I hadn't have done it, if I hadn't have taken the big risk, which I literally went to bed every night for about 8 months going, I hate this, I'm never doing it again. I'm not cut out for this. And then we got there, and that was the payoff. I think the universe, God, whatever you want to call it, it's just like, if you show up, there will be these rewards, and they might not be what you expect. I didn't make a penny from the business, but had lots of happy customers and came away with my husband.
Wow, what an amazing story to end on. Thank you so much. I enjoyed listening to you when I was privileged enough to be in the audience, and it's a real treat to have you on the podcast. I think you're so inspirational. You're so honest with your story, and I think there's a lot we can all learn from the experiences you've had. And yeah, just great to have you, Benita. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Helen.
You've been listening to mountaineer Benita Norris sharing the rather unlikely story of how she summited Everest at the age of 22 and some of the life lessons she's learned. Download our podcast at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple and Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to yours. I'll be back next week with another great guest, so join me then.